The second lesson, the ego's mental tools. In the first lesson, we gave instruction and exercises designed to awaken the consciousness of the candidate to a realization of the real I. We confined our instructions to the preliminary teachings of the reality of the I and the means whereby the candidate might be brought to a realization of his real self and its independence from the body and the things of the flesh. We tried to show you how you might awaken to a consciousness of the reality of the I, its real nature, its independence of the body, its immortality, its invincibility and invulnerability. How well we have succeeded may be determined only by the experience of each candidate, for we can but point out the way, and the candidate must do the real work himself. But there is more to be said and done in this matter of awakening to a realization of the I. So far, we have but told you how to distinguish between the material coverings of the ego and the I itself. We have tried to show you that you had a real I, and then to show you what it was, and how it was independent of the material coverings, etc. But there is still another step in this self-analysis, a more difficult step. Even when the candidate has awakened to a realization of his independence of the body and material coverings, he often confounds the I with the lower principles of the mind. This is a mistake. The mind, in its various phases and planes, is but a tool and instrument of the I, and is far from being the I itself. We shall try to bring out this fact in this lesson and its accompanying exercises. We shall avoid and pass by the metaphysical features of the case, and shall confine ourselves to the yogi psychology. We shall not touch upon theories, nor attempt to explain the cause, nature, and purpose of the mind, the working tool of the ego, but instead shall attempt to point out a way whereby you may analyze the mind and then determine which is the not-I and which is the real I. It is useless to burden you with theories or metaphysical talk when the way to prove the thing is right within your own grasp. By using the mind, you will be able to separate it into its parts and force it to give you its own answer to the questions touching itself. In the second and third lessons of our 14 lessons, we pointed out to you the fact that man had three mental principles, or subdivisions of mind, all of which were below the plane of spirit. The I is spirit, but its mental principles are of a lower order. Without wishing to unduly repeat ourselves, we think it better to run hastily over these three principles in the mind of man. First, there is what is known as the instinctive mind, which man shares in common with the lower animals. It is the first principle of mind that appears in the scale of evolution. In its lowest phases, consciousness is but barely perceptible, and mere sensation is apparent. In its higher stages, it almost reaches the plane of reason or intellect. In fact, they overlap each other, or rather, blend into each other. The instinctive mind does valuable work in the direction of maintaining animal life in our bodies, it having charge of this part of our being. It attends to the constant work of repair, replacement, change, digestion, assimilation, elimination, etc., all of which work is performed below the plane of consciousness. But this is but a small part of the work of the instinctive mind, for this part of the mind has stored up all the experiences of ourselves and ancestors in our evolution from the lower forms of animal life into the present stage of evolution. All of the old animal instincts, which were all right in their place and quite necessary for the well-being of the lower forms of life, have left traces in this part of the mind, which traces are apt to come to the front under pressure of unusual circumstances, even long after we think we have outgrown them. In this part of the mind are to be found traces of the old fighting instinct of the animal, all the animal passions, all the hate, envy, jealousy, and the rest of it, which are our inheritances from the past. The instinctive mind is also the habit mind, in which is stored up all the little and great habits of many lives, or rather such as have not been entirely effaced by subsequent habits of a stronger nature. The instinctive mind is a queer storehouse containing quite a variety of objects, many of them very good in their way, but others of which are the worst kind of old junk and rubbish. This part of the mind also is the seat of the appetites, passions, desires, instincts, sensations, feelings, and emotions of the lower order, manifested in the lower animals, primitive man, the barbarian, and the man of today, the difference being only in the degree of control over them that has been gained by the higher parts of the mind. There are higher desires, aspirations, etc., belonging to a higher part of the mind, which we will describe in a few minutes, but the animal nature belongs to the instinctive mind. To it also belong the feelings belonging to our emotional and passional nature. All animal desires, such as hunger and thirst, sexual desires on the physical plane, all passions, such as physical love, hatred, envy, malice, jealousy, revenge, etc., are parts of this part of the mind. The desire for the physical, unless a means of reaching higher things, and the longing for the material, belong to this region of the mind. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, etc., belong to the instinctive mind. Take note, however, that we are not condemning the things belonging to this plane of the mind. All of them have their place. Many were necessary in the past, and many are still necessary for the continuance of physical life. All are right in their place, and to those in the particular plane of development to which they belong, and are wrong only when one is mastered by them or when he returns to pick up an unworthy thing that has been cast off in the unfoldment of the individual. This lesson has nothing to do with the right and wrong of these things. We have treated of that elsewhere. And we mention this part of the mind so that you may understand that you have such a thing in your mental makeup, and that you may understand the thought, etc., coming from it, when we start in to analyze the mind in the latter part of this lesson. All we will ask you to do at this stage of the lesson is to realize that this part of the mind, while belonging to you, is not you, yourself. It is not the I part of you. Next in order, above the instinctive mind, is what we have called the intellect, that part of the mind that does our reasoning, analyzing, thinking, etc. You are using it in the consideration of this lesson. But note this, you are using it, but it is not you, any more than was the instinctive mind that you considered a moment ago. You will begin to make the separation if you will think but a moment. We will not take up your time with the consideration of intellect or reason. You will find a good description of this part of the mind in any good elementary work on psychology. Our only idea in mentioning it is that you may make the classification, and that we may afterwards show you that the intellect is but a tool of the ego, instead of being the real I itself, as so many seem to imagine. The third and highest mental principle is what is called the spiritual mind, that part of the mind which is almost unknown to many of the race, but which has developed into consciousness with nearly all who read this lesson. For the fact that the subject of this lesson attracts you is a proof that this part of your mental nature is unfolding into consciousness. This region of the mind is the source of that which we call genius, inspiration, spirituality, and all that we consider the highest in our mental makeup. All the great thoughts and ideas float into the field of consciousness from this part of the mind. All the great unfoldment of the race comes from there. All the higher mental ideas that have come to man in his upward evolutionary journey, that tend in the direction of nobility, true religious feeling, kindness, humanity, justice, unselfish love, mercy, sympathy, etc., have come to him through his slowly unfolding spiritual mind. His love of God and of his fellow man have come in this way. His knowledge of the great occult truths reach him through this channel. The mental realization of the I, which we are endeavoring to teach in these lessons, must come to him by way of the spiritual mind unfolding its ideas into his field of consciousness. But even this great and wonderful part of the mind is but a tool, a highly finished one, it is true, but still a tool to the ego or I. We propose to give you a little mental drill work toward the end that you may be able more readily to distinguish the I from the mind or mental states. In this connection, we would say that every part, plane, and function of the mind is good and necessary, and the student must not fall into the error of supposing that because we tell him to set aside first this part of the mind and then that part, that we are undervaluing the mind, or that we regard it as an encumbrance or hindrance. Far from this, we realize that it is by the use of the mind that man is enabled to arrive at a knowledge of his true nature and self, and that his progress through many stages yet will depend upon the unfolding of his mental faculties. Man is now using but the lower and inferior parts of his mind, and he has within his mental world great unexplored regions that far surpass anything of which the human mind has dreamed. In fact, it is part of the business of Raja Yoga to aid in unfolding these higher faculties and mental regions. And so far from decrying the mind, the Raja Yoga teachers are chiefly concerned in recognizing the mind's power and possibilities, and directing the student to avail himself of the latent powers that are inherent in his soul. It is only by the mind that the teachings we are now giving you may be grasped and understood, and used to your advantage and benefit. We are talking direct to your mind now, and are making appeals to it, that it may be interested and may open itself to what is ready to come into it from its own higher regions. We are appealing to the intellect to direct its attention to this great matter, that it may interpose less resistance to the truths that are waiting to be projected from the spiritual mind which knows the truth. Mental drill. Place yourself in a calm, restful condition, that you may be able to meditate upon the matters that we shall place before you for consideration. Allow the matters presented to meet with a hospitable reception from you, and hold a mental attitude of willingness to receive what may be waiting for you in the higher regions of your mind. We wish to call your attention to several mental impressions or conditions, one after another, in order that you may realize that they are merely something incident to you, and not you yourself, that you may set them aside and consider them just as you might anything that you have been using. You cannot set the I aside and so consider it, but the various forms of the not I may be so set aside and considered. In the first lesson, you gained the perception of the I as independent from the body, the latter being merely an instrument for use. You have now arrived at the stage when the I appears to you to be a mental creature, a bundle of thoughts, feelings, moods, etc. But you must go farther. You must be able to distinguish the I from these mental conditions, which are as much tools as is the body and its parts. Let us begin by considering the thoughts more closely connected with the body, and then work up to the higher mental states. The sensations of the body, such as hunger, thirst, pain, pleasurable sensations, physical desires, etc., etc., are not apt to be mistaken for essential qualities of the I by many of the candidates, for they have passed beyond this stage and have learned to set aside these sensations to a greater or lesser extent by an effort of the will, and are no longer slaves to them. Not that they do not experience these sensations, but they have grown to regard them as incidents of the physical life, good in their place, but useful to the advanced man only when he has mastered them to the extent that he no longer regards them as close to the eye. And yet, to some people, these sensations are so closely identified with their conception of the eye that when they think of themselves, they think merely of a bundle of these sensations. They are not able to set them aside and consider them as things apart, to be used when necessary and proper, but as things not fastened to the eye. The more advanced a man becomes, the farther off seem these sensations. Not that he does not feel hungry, for instance, not at all, for he recognizes hunger and satisfies it within reason, knowing that his physical body is making demands for attention and that these demands should be heeded. But, mark the difference, instead of feeling that the eye is hungry, the man feels that my body is hungry, just as he might become conscious that his horse or dog was crying for food insistently. Do you see what we mean? It is that the man no longer identifies himself, the eye, with the body. Consequently, the thoughts which are most closely allied to the physical life seem comparatively separate from his eye conception. Such a man thinks my stomach this or my leg that or my body thus instead of I this or I that. He is able almost automatically to think of the body and its sensations as things of him and belonging to him, which require attention and care, rather than as real parts of the I. He is able to form a conception of the I as existing without any of these things, without the body and its sensations, and so he has taken the first step in the realization of the I. Before going on, we ask the students to stop a few moments and mentally run over these sensations of the body. Form a mental image of them and realize that they are merely incidents to the present stage of growth and experience of the I, and that they form no real part of it. They may and will be left behind in the ego's higher planes of advancement. You may have attained this mental conception perfectly long since, but we ask that, to give yourself the mental drill at this time, in order to fasten upon your mind this first step. In realizing that you are able to set aside, mentally, these sensations, that you are able to hold them out at arm's length and consider them as an outside thing, you mentally determine that they are not-I things, and you set them down in the not-I collection, the first to be placed there. Let us try to make this still plainer, even at the risk of wearying you by repetitions, for you must get this idea firmly fixed in your mind. To be able to say that a thing is not I, you must realize that there are two things in question. One, the not I thing, and two, the I who is regarding the not I thing, just as the I regards a lump of sugar or a mountain. Do you see what we mean? Keep at it until you do. Next, consider some of the emotions, such as anger, hate, love in its ordinary forms, jealousy, ambition, and the 101 other emotions that sweep through our brains. You will find that you are able to set each one of these emotions or feelings aside and study it, dissect it, analyze it, consider it. You will be able to understand the rise, progress, and end of each of these feelings as they have come to you, and as you recall them in your memory or imagination, just as readily as you would were you observing their occurrence in the mind of a friend. You will find them all stored away in some parts of your mental makeup, and you may, to use a modern American slang phrase, make them trot before you and show their paces. Don't you see that they are not you, that they are merely something that you carry around with you in a mental bag? You can imagine yourself as living without them and still being I, can you not? And the fact that you are able to set them aside and examine and consider them is a proof that they are not I things, For there are two things in the matter. One, you who are examining and considering them, and two, the thing itself, which is the object of the examination and consideration at mental arm's length. So into the not-I collection go these emotions, desirable and undesirable. The collection is steadily growing, and will attain quite formidable proportions after a while. Now, do not imagine that this is a lesson designed to teach you how to discard these emotions, although if it enables you to get rid of the undesirable ones, so much the better. This is not our object, for we bid you place the desirable, at this time, ones, in with the opposite kind, the idea being to bring you to a realization that the I is higher, above and independent of these mental somethings. And then, when you have realized the nature of the I, you may return and use, as a master, the things that have been using you as a slave. So do not be afraid to throw these emotions, good and bad, into the not-I collection. You may go back to them and use the good ones after the mental drill is over. No matter how much you may think that you are bound by any of these emotions, you will realize by careful analysis that it is of the not-I kind. For the I existed before the emotion came into active play, and it will live long after the emotion has faded away. The principal proof is that you are able to hold it out at arm's length and examine it, a proof that it is not I. Run through the entire list of your feelings, emotions, moods, and whatnot, just as you would those of a well-known friend or relative, and you will see that each one, everyone, is a not I thing. And you will lay it aside for the time, for the purpose of the scientific experiment, at least. Then passing on to the intellect, you will be able to hold out for examination each mental process and principle. You don't believe it, you may say. Then read and study some good work on psychology, and you will learn to dissect and analyze every intellectual process, and to classify it and place it in the proper pigeonhole. Study psychology by means of some good textbook, and you will find that one by one, every intellectual process is classified and talked about and labeled, just as you would a collection of flowers. If that does not satisfy you, turn the leaves of some work on logic, and you will admit that you may hold these intellectual processes at arm's length and examine them and talk about them to others. So that these wonderful tools of man, the intellectual powers, may be placed in the not-I collection, for the I is capable of standing aside and viewing them. It is able to detach them from itself. The most remarkable thing about this is that in admitting this fact, you realize that the I is using these very intellectual faculties to pass upon themselves. Who is the master that compels these faculties to do this to themselves? The master of the mind, the I. And reaching the highest regions of the mind, even the spiritual mind, you will be compelled to admit that the things that have come into consciousness from that region may be considered and studied, just as may be any other mental thing, and so even these high things must be placed in the not-I collection. You may object that this does not prove that all the things in the spiritual mind may be so treated, that there may be high things there that cannot be so treated. We will not discuss this question, for you know nothing about the spiritual mind except as it has revealed itself to you, and the higher regions of that mind are like the mind of a god when compared to what you call mind. But the evidence of the illumined, those in whom the spiritual mind has wonderfully unfolded, tell us that even in the highest forms of development, the initiates, yea, even the masters, realize that above even their highest mental states, there is always that eternal I, brooding over them as the sun over the lake, and that the highest conception of the I, known even to advanced souls, is but a faint reflection of the I filtering through the spiritual mind, although that spiritual mind is as clear as the clearest crystal when compared with our comparatively opaque mental states. And the highest mental state is but a tool or instrument of the I, and not the I itself. And yet the I is to be found in the faintest forms of consciousness, and animates even the unconscious life. The I is always the same, but its apparent growth is the result of the mental unfoldment of the individual. As we described it in one of the lessons of the Advanced Course, it is like an electric lamp that is encased in many wrappings of cloth. As cloth after cloth is removed, the light seems to grow brighter and stronger, and yet it has changed not, the change being in the removal of the confining and bedimming coverings. We do not expect to make you realize the I in all its fullness. That is far beyond the highest known to man of today, but we do hope to bring you to a realization of the highest conception of the I possible to each of you in your present stage of unfoldment, and in the process we expect to cause to drop from you some of the confining sheaths that you have about outgrown. The sheaths are ready for dropping, and all that is required is the touch of a friendly hand to cause them to fall fluttering from you. We wish to bring you to the fullest possible, to you, realization of the I, in order to make an individual of you, in order that you may understand and have courage to take up the tools and instruments lying at your hand and do the work before you. And now, back to the mental drill. After you have satisfied yourself that about everything that you are capable of thinking about is a not-I thing, a tool and instrument for your use, you will ask, and now, what is there left that should not be thrown in the not-I collection? To this question we answer, the I itself. And when you demand a proof, we say, try to set aside the I for consideration. You may try from now until the passing away of infinities, and you will never be able to set aside the real I for consideration. You may think you can, but a little reflection will show you that you are merely setting aside some of your mental qualities or faculties. And in this process, what is the I doing? Simply setting aside and considering things. Can you not see that the I cannot be both the considerer and the thing considered, the examiner and the thing examined? Can the sun shine upon itself by its own light? You may consider the I of some other person, but it is your I that is considering. But you cannot, as an I, stand aside and see yourself as an I. Then what evidence have we that there is an I to us? This, that you are always conscious of being the considerer and examiner instead of the considered and examined thing. And then you have the evidence of your consciousness. And what report does this consciousness give us? Simply this and nothing more. I am. That is all that the I is conscious of regarding its true self. I am. But that consciousness is worth all the rest, for the rest is but not I tools that the I may reach out and use. And so, at the final analysis, you will find that there is something that refuses to be set aside and examined by the I. And that something is the I itself. That I, eternal, unchangeable, that drop of the great spirit ocean, that spark from the sacred flame. Just as you find it impossible to imagine the I as dead, so will you find it impossible to set aside the I for consideration. All that comes to you is the testimony, I am. If you are able to set aside the I for consideration, who would be the one to consider it? Who could consider except the I itself? And if it be here, how could it be there? The I cannot be the not I, even in the wildest flights of the imagination. The imagination, with all its boasted freedom and power, confesses itself vanquished when asked to do this thing. O students, may you be brought to a realization of what you are. May you soon awaken to the fact that you are sleeping gods, that you have within you the power of the universe, awaiting your word to manifest in action. Long ages have you toiled to get this far, and long must you travel before you reach even the first great temple. but you are now entering into the conscious state of spiritual evolution. No longer will your eyes be closed as you walk the path. From now on, you will begin to see clearer and clearer each step in the dawning light of consciousness. You are in touch with all of life, and the separation of your I from the great universal I is but apparent and temporary. We will tell you of these things in our third lesson, but before you can grasp that, you must develop the I consciousness within you. Do not lay aside this matter as one of no importance. Do not dismiss our weak explanation as being merely words, 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 as so many are inclined to do. We are pointing out a great truth to you. Why not follow the leadings of the Spirit, which even now, this moment while you read, is urging you to walk the path of attainment? Consider the teachings of this lesson, and practice the mental drill until your mind has grasped its significance, and then let it sink deep down into your inner consciousness. Then will you be ready for the next lessons and those to follow. Practice this mental drill until you are fully assured of the reality of the I and the relativity of the not-I in the mind. When you once grasp this truth, you will find that you will be able to use the mind with far greater power and effect, for you will recognize that it is your tool and instrument, fitted and intended to do your bidding. You will be able to master your moods and emotions when necessary, and will rise from the position of a slave to a master. Our words seem cheap and poor when we consider the greatness of the truth that we are endeavoring to convey by means of them. For who can find words to express the inexpressible? All that we may hope to do is awaken a keen interest and attention on your part so that you will practice the mental drill, and thus obtain the evidence of your own mentality to the truth. Truth is not truth to you until you have proven it in your own experience, and once so proven, you cannot be robbed of it, nor can it be argued away from you. You must realize that in every mental effort, you, the I, are behind it. You bid the mind work, and it obeys your will. You are the master and not the slave of your mind. You are the driver, not the driven. Shake yourself loose from the tyranny of the mind that has oppressed you for so long. Assert yourself and be free. We will help you in this direction during the course of these lessons, but you must first assert yourself as a master of your mind. Sign the mental declaration of independence from your moods, emotions, and uncontrolled thoughts, and assert your domination over them. Enter into your kingdom, thou manifestation of the Spirit. While this lesson is intended primarily to bring clearly into your consciousness the fact that the I is a reality separate and distinct from its mental tools, and while the control of the mental faculties by the will forms a part of some of the future lessons, still, we think that this is a good place to point out to you the advantages arising from a realization of the true nature of the I and the relative aspect of the mind. Many of us have supposed that our minds were the masters of ourselves, and we have allowed ourselves to be tormented and worried by thoughts running away with us and presenting themselves at inopportune moments. The initiate is relieved from this annoyance, for he learns to assert his mastery over the different parts of the mind and controls and regulates his mental processes just as one would a fine piece of machinery. He is able to control his conscious thinking faculties and direct their work to the best advantage. And he also learns how to pass on orders to the subconscious mental region and bid it work for him while he sleeps, or even when he is using his conscious mind in other matters. These subjects will be considered by us in due time during the course of lessons. In this connection, it may be interesting to read what Edward Carpenter says of the power of the individual to control his thought processes. In his book, From Adam's Peak to Elephanta, in describing his experience while visiting a Hindu Jnani Yogi, he says, And if we are unwilling to believe in this internal mastery over the body, we are perhaps almost equally unaccustomed to the idea of mastery over our own inner thoughts and feelings. That a man should be a prey to any thought that chances to take possession of his mind is commonly among us assumed as unavoidable. It may be a matter of regret that he should be kept awake all night from anxiety as to the issue of a lawsuit on the morrow, but that he should have the power of determining whether he be kept awake or not seems an extravagant demand. The image of an impending calamity is no doubt odious, but its very odiousness, we say, makes it haunt the mind all the more pertinaciously, and it is useless to try to expel it. Yet this is an absurd position, for man, the heir of all the ages, hag-ridden by the flimsy creatures of his own brain. If a pebble in our boot torments us, we expel it. We take off the boot and shake it out. And once the matter is fairly understood, it is just as easy to expel an intruding and obnoxious thought from the mind. About this, there ought to be no mistake, no two opinions. The thing is obvious, clear, and unmistakable. It should be as easy to expel an obnoxious thought from your mind as it is to shake a stone out of your shoe. Until a man can do that, it is just nonsense to talk about his ascendancy over nature and all the rest of it. He is a mere slave and prey to the bat-winged phantoms that flit through the corridors of his own brain. Yet the weary and careworn faces that we meet by thousands, even among the affluent classes of civilization, testify only too clearly how seldom this mastery is obtained, how rare indeed to meet a man, how common rather to discover a creature hounded on by tyrant thoughts or cares or desires, cowering, wincing under the lash, or perchance priding himself to run merrily in obedience to a driver that rattles the reins and persuades him that he is free, whom we cannot converse with in careless tête-à-tête because that alien presence is always there on the watch. It is one of the most prominent doctrines of Raja Yoga that the power of expelling thoughts, or if need be, killing them dead on the spot, must be attained. Naturally, the art requires practice, but like other arts, when once acquired, there is no mystery or difficulty about it, and it is worth practice. It may indeed fairly be said that life only begins when this art has been acquired. For obviously, when instead of being ruled by individual thoughts, the whole flock of them in their immense multitude and variety and capacity is ours to direct and dispatch and employ where we list, for he maketh the winds his messengers and the flaming fire his minister, life becomes a thing so vast and grand compared with what it was before that its former condition may well appear almost antenatal. If you can kill a thought dead for the time being, you can do anything else with it that you please, and therefore it is that this power is so valuable. And it not only frees a man from mental torment, which is 9/10 at least of the torment of life, but it gives him a concentrated power of handling mental work absolutely unknown to him before. The two things are correlative to each other. As already said, this is one of the principles of Raja Yoga. While at work, your thought is to be absolutely concentrated in it, undistracted by anything whatever irrelevant to the matter at hand, pounding away like a great engine with giant power and perfect economy, no wear and tear of friction or dislocation of parts owing to the working of different forces at the same time. Then, when the work is finished, if there is no more occasion for the use of the machine, it must stop equally, absolutely, stop entirely, no worrying, as if a parcel of boys were allowed to play their devilments with the locomotive as soon as it was in the shed, and the man must retire into that region of his consciousness where his true self dwells. I say the power of the thought machine itself is enormously increased by this faculty of letting it alone on the one hand, and of using it singly and with concentration on the other. It becomes a true tool, which a master workman lays down when done with, but which only a bungler carries about with him all the time to show that he is the possessor of it. We ask the students to read carefully the above quotations from Mr. Carpenter's book, for they are full of suggestions that may be taken up to advantage by those who are emancipating themselves from their slavery to the unmastered mind, and who are now bringing the mind under control of the ego by means of the will. Our next lesson will take up the subject of the relationship of the I to the universal I, and will be called The Expansion of the Self. It will deal with the subject not from a theoretical standpoint, but from the position of the teacher who is endeavoring to make his students actually aware in their consciousness of the truth of the proposition. In this course, we are not trying to make our students past masters of theory, but are endeavoring to place them in a position whereby they may know for themselves and actually experience the things of which we teach. Therefore, we urge upon you not to merely rest content with reading this lesson, but instead to study and meditate upon the teachings mentioned under the head of mental drill until the distinctions stand out clearly in your mind, and until you not only believe them to be true, but actually are conscious of the I and its mental tools. Have patience and perseverance. The task may be difficult, but the reward is great. To become conscious of the greatness, majesty, strength, and power of your real being is worth years of hard study. Do you not think so? Then study and practice hopefully, diligently, and earnestly. Peace be with you. Mantrams, affirmations for the second lesson. I am an entity. My mind is my instrument of expression. I exist independent of my mind, and am not dependent upon it for existence or being. I am master of my mind, not its slave. I can set aside my sensations, emotions, passions, desires, intellectual faculties, and all the rest of my mental collections of tools as not I things, and still there remains something, and that something is I, which cannot be set aside by me, for it is my very self, my only self, my real self, I. That which remains after all that may be set aside is set aside is the I, myself, eternal, constant, unchangeable. I am.